Welcome, everyone, to our February seminar series. We are delighted to welcome back Dr. Elaine France, Professor of History at Kent State University. She is going to talk about Frances Willard and the Women's Christian Temperance Union. I think it's a fascinating topic in our American history, and I know you will enjoy it. Please join me in welcoming Dr. France.
We go. Let's try this. Go. Yeah. Sorry about that. So today we're going to do the first of four discussions of the temperance movement at the end of the 19th century. And it's going to focus on, is this working? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Largely on Frances Willard. And I love Frances Willard. We're going to be talking. I'm going to try to make the case, because I think when people think about the temperance movement, they have kind of a negative connotation, like these people are sort of prudish. These people are, I don't know. They seem sort of boring, even, you know. But I'm going to make the case that they're actually very radical, and they were very impactful, and they were hugely successful, and so. I want to talk now. I started working on them. That was the first thing I worked on as a graduate student. It was the first, you know, area that I wanted to study was the temperance movement. And that was my first book, was on that topic. And then I moved on to other things, but I kept on, especially with the women's movement recently, you know, the women's marches. I kept on thinking back to the temperance movement and thinking, you know, how many times really have women run a huge national movement that was very impactful, and it's not that many times. And this is the first one. So I want to talk a little bit. Go take us back to 1874, the very end of 1873 to 1874, and the Women's Temperance Crusades, which are going to launch the WCTU. The Women's Christian Temperance Union, which is still around. You can still join the WCTU. They get very upset if you talk about them in the past tense. I would make the claim that they were I feel very confident in saying they were the most important women's movement until the 1970s, you know, and they were much, much bigger than the suffrage movement. And suffrage wouldn't have happened without them. They were actually probably the prime mover of the suffrage movement. So this is what we'll be talking about today. And so I guess I'll get launched with that. But I'll also say, here's my secret issue is that I love Frances Willard so much. So we'll see Frances Willard. There's some issues with Frances Willard too. She could be racist, right? But I have so much admiration for her that I'm tempted to get a great big tattoo of her on my arm. And I'm trying to decide whether to do that. So maybe this month will help me decide whether to get a great big face of Frances Willard sitting on my arm. So I'll be thinking about this as we speak. So, okay. So, and I want to thank Sarah and Ted for organizing all this. It's a lot of work, so you should appreciate that. Okay. So, in 1873, and I'm not going to read this whole thing, but I have a nice written out intro, so I'll start with that. In 1873, it seemed impossible to imagine taking down the liquor industry in the United States. Men, women, and children drank regularly, and alcohol was still a key component of medicine. Even little babies, you know, if they were fussing, you're supposed to give them a little bit of alcohol, you know, to sort of soothe them. Saloons, groceries, and pharmacies dotted almost every town selling liquor. Liquor businesses were huge, and they were growing. So particularly breweries were growing because of German immigration. The 431 breweries in the United States in 1850 had grown to over 1,200 in 1860 and to 4,131 by 1873, the year of the, so they were just, these spaces of drink were just exploding, and they were rapidly becoming more centralized and powerful. The people selling alcohol were beginning to centralize, like so many American businesses at this time, right? In the post-war nationalization of industry, Budweiser became the first to develop railroad double-walled cars for chilled transportation, becoming a national brand. Pabst and Schlitz were not far behind, and liquor taxes were a fifth of all federal revenues. The federal government was dependent on it for taxes. And the state and local governments were often deeply connected with and supported by the liquor businesses, which were often centers of local political life and often even served as polling places. When you went to vote, you'd often go to the local bar, which would have been turned into a polling place. And not only in big cities, but everywhere, political candidates, you know, political leaders would hang out at bars and saloons, you know, and so they became, saloon keepers were politically very important figures. The liquor supporters had a strong argument. Personal liberty was their motto, is that people should be allowed to do what they want. And a strong political party, the Democratic Party, which was deeply invested in defending it. Immigrants, of whom there were many, this is a great age of immigration, right, tended to favor the free circulation, the free sale of alcohol. Liquor supporters also benefited from an inescapable practical reality. Local, state, and federal governments absolutely lacked the practical ability in terms of surveillance, information management, and a monopoly of violence to implement any sort of practical prohibition. So there was all sorts of reasons why it would be very hard to somehow stop the sales of, I mean, think about how hard it is for us to stop drug sales now, right? Imagine when the state was much weaker, right? You know, it was just very, very hard for it to do it, even if it had wanted to, but it's getting stronger right after the Civil War. This is beginning to change. The women's temperance movement, however, brought the industry to its knees. It was the largest women's movement of the 19th century. The hundreds of thousands of women throughout the nation, but especially in the Midwest, who involved themselves in it, profoundly reshaped the nation in countless ways far beyond the prohibitory laws. Yet, temperance reformers have often been overlooked. In their own day, they were characterized as self-righteous, impractical women trying to manage things where they did not belong. After prohibition turned sour, an entire generation defined themselves against them, and temperance became sort of a historical byword for impracticality and moralism. When I do a U.S. history course, I always talk about the temperance movement, but the temperance movement has very little space in history textbooks, right? And in sort of, you know, our historical narrative, despite its extreme importance, I think for these reasons. There are many different reasons why even U.S. historians don't spend much time thinking about the temperance movement today. They were at times deeply implicated in racism. They were often very racist. They were often very anti-Catholic. And they were often big fans of imperialism. They loved, you know, telling the, you know, the Africans what they can drink and, you know, things like this. This was a group which was launched with a movement it called a crusade. And the use of the term crusade was not innocent, right? They were thinking about a religious crusade. This was a Christian group. And their gender politics, the gender politics of the temperance movement was a little problematic. They were a women's rights group, I think, in many ways. Really believed that one thing that they needed to do was restore men to their natural position as leaders, right, by getting them sober so that they could run families better, right? But they should remain in charge, right? And that's what's going on. So for all these reasons, I haven't been talked about too much, but I want to talk to you about what happened with the women's Christian church. And today we're actually not going to get, we're going to only get to Frances Willard, the sort of star of the WCTU, at the very end of this talk, because we're going to talk about the event, the crusade of 1874, that was going to launch her. She's going to show up in an unexpected place at the very end. So let's do this. Okay, so I'm pressing this. Is it maybe not on? Is that the problem? It's giving me a red. Nothing's happening when I click. I think I'm supposed to yell, Ted. Are you going to press it? It's just going to move? No. Okay. Well, we can actually get moving without it. So basically what happens, it begins at Christmas, a week before Christmas in 1873, and it begins in a place called, you got right now? Okay, perfect. Yes. Oh, I can go back. Okay, yeah. So here's the problem, right? The problem is that, you know, men are assembling in these bars, they're spending all the money, they're, you know, becoming intoxicated, sometimes while voting. They're letting their votes be bought by officials, you know, in these elections. They're while they're drunk, they're behaving badly. They're doing things like attack. Yes, that's the big one. And that's what we're going to be focusing largely on. They're doing things like beating up their wives and children, and also neglecting their wives and children by spending the money and then coming home and not having any money. And at this time, women couldn't own money. So even if women were working, which they sometimes were, the man had all the control over the money, right? So there was no way for women to say, oh, you're not allowed to spend this money on this, right? But they were also doing things like harassing people in the streets, you know, and things like that. And they're also doing things like getting injured, running out in front of a train and, you know, or, you know, falling off of something and getting injured. And then they can't support their, or getting killed, right? Then they can't support their families. So there's all sorts of problems with outcome. We'll talk about exactly how they start articulating them. So in 1873, what happens in a church in Hillsboro, Ohio, it's the Hillsboro First Presbyterian Church. And I want to say that not only is this a Christian story, it's actually very much a Presbyterian story specifically. The Presbyterians are really central to the temperance movement. Frances Willard is a Methodist, but many of the most important people in the movement are Presbyterians. Okay, so what happens in 1873? There's a man named Dr. Diocletian Lewis, who is invited to lecture at Hillsboro, Ohio, and another a nearby place called Washington Courthouse, Ohio. And he's supposed to, it's actually a lecture on girls' health and hygiene. But in giving this lecture, he talks about alcohol as a problem. That's another lecture he had. So he throws that in and he says, back in the day, my mom and like a bunch of other ladies went out to the saloon and they just like stormed into the saloon and they just shut down the saloon. And so he makes this mention. And after the lecture, the women who were at this event start saying, you know what, actually, we would love to do something similar. And so they actually go out, they get together into a group, they wear all white. These are middle-class, middle-aged, older, some younger, right? It's a span, but it's largely dominated by sort of middle-aged women, Christian, white, Midwestern, middle-class, middle-aged women. And they decide they're gonna go out and they're gonna march to a saloon, to all the saloons in town, and they're going to make them shut down. And that's exactly what they do. They do go out, they march out, and they actually convince the saloon keepers to close The way they do that is by promising them that if they turn their business into something else, like if you sell groceries or whatever, like we will give you our patronage, you know, and, but also just shaming them. They start, some of them fold quickly, but others, they actually go out every day for several days and they kneel outside of the saloon and they sing hymns. And then eventually they go inside the saloons and they kneel on the floors, the sawdust floors with like people would spit on them and stuff. And these ladies are in their white dresses and they go in and they kneel down and they sing hymns, they pray, and they kind of siege these saloons and they are successful. The saloons in this small town close. And similarly in Washington Courthouse, the saloons close, completely. And this gets picked up by the newspapers. And the newspapers go crazy, and it takes over like the front page of many newspapers for the first half of 1874. It spreads it to, we know of over 900 communities, and you know, which includes small towns and cities where it spreads to. We know that over 150,000 women were mobilized doing this. And this is unprecedented. Women had never gone out in groups in the street before, right? It, you know, respectable women had never gone out in groups. You know, prostitutes would go out like for Mardi Gras or something, you know, but like respectable women had never gone out on the streets before marching for something. There were some men, usually a religious men, like maybe ministers would follow the women. And men would support them in various ways that we'll talk about. So just to give you a sense of how important this becomes, the New York Times mentions it in 73 articles in March of 1874. But that's just a sample that I did. They succeed in getting local prohibition and various regulations and better enforcement, which is what they're looking for. They get these saloons to close all over the country. But they also get where they succeed, right? But they also start pushing for all sorts of, not just prohibition, because you're not going to get national prohibition for a long time, national prohibition, but they get local prohibition. They get all sorts of new regulations to shut down saloons on Sundays, you know, to not sell to drunk people, you know, all sorts of things like that. So they have a lot of political success. This movement gets covered internationally. Even Mark Twain is asked to comment on it on a trip to England. And I've always been fascinated by this because he's such an interesting figure. But he says, he's in London and he hears about this and he's called upon to comment on it. And he says, "I cannot help glorifying in the pluck of these women, sad as it is to see them displaying themselves in these unwomanly ways. It does not become us to scoff at the Crusaders, but it does become us to admire their heroism." So this was definitely a big deal. What I want to talk about, first, I want to show you a couple of images of the Crusaders and what this looks like, what they're doing. And then I want to talk a little bit about I have a list of five principles that, why were they so successful? And what were their sort of principles that I think were very wise, how they became such a successful movement. Okay, and here we go. Going to move this forward. Okay, so these are all contemporary images of the Crusaders. Sorry, the images are a little, like, they're drawings, obviously. There are some, actually, I have a photograph too, maybe two. But this is a drawing, it's Harper's, of what it looked like in the Crusades with them in there kneeling. These ones are not wearing white. They vary from place to place. Here's a photograph of the Temperance Crusaders. And I think this may be Hillsborough. It went all over the country, right? And definitely including a lot of Western Pennsylvania, including Pittsburgh, which we'll get to. It got to the biggest cities. It got to the West Coast, but it's hard. And it got to the South, which was not good movement. You know, areas, it's hard to have a political movement in the South for various reasons, including, you know, just racial tension. It was very much centered in the Midwest. It was very much largely a Midwestern movement, and particularly centered in Ohio. But Pennsylvania was very important. Okay, these are the women. This is some of the women who ended up being the leaders of the Temperance Crusades. You can kind of just kind of get a sense of very, very, a Mother Stuart, who's the second one from the left, is probably the most important of the leaders up there. Just very prosperous women, middle-class women, right? You know, and respected in their communities. Often their husbands had a important position, and they were usually at home. But they got out there, and like, there's images, I don't have it here, but there's images of Mother Stuart, for instance, like standing on like a ledge on a building in a city, just like standing on a ledge, talking to a huge crowd. Like she just went out there on a ledge and she's just like, you know, addressing this crowd. Like these women were really tough, right? Okay, we'll get to some of this, but I want to say that also, I want to talk about for just a second what it actually looked like on the ground for the at the regular Temperance Crusades when you get past the leaders. Basically, what would happen with the Temperance Crusade when it reached an area is that there would be some sort of, and I guess maybe we'll go to this church for that reason, there'd be some sort of meeting which initiated the crusade. Usually the minister of the church would be interested, but he'd be approached by you know, people within his church, and he would offer them the use of his church. And they would assemble there and have like a sort of planning meeting. And this is actually where the Pittsburgh Crusades was started, was at the Third Presbyterian Church. So they would assemble there, they would come up with their plan, and they would make their list of saloon keepers, saloons that they planned to stop at, and they would sort of besiege them. And they would go out every day at kind of at the end of men's work days, right? And they would, you know, position themselves at these saloons. They do exactly what the Hillsborough people had been doing. They actually even, I thought I had more pictures. No, that's not. Okay. Well, I have a wonderful image of, which I didn't send here, of a sort of shelter that they built outside of one of the saloons. They actually built like a lean-to outside one of the saloons because it was cold, you know, and they had to like, but they would go out and they would stay the whole time. They would have shifts that would go out. They would kind of march through town from one saloon to the other. And then when they did triumph, when a saloon keeper agreed finally to close down his business, they would destroy the liquor. And this is before Carrie Nation. You know, we think about Carrie Nation, who was really a generation later, sort of following them. Carrie Nation's like 1900 in Kansas. But they would take hatchets and they would destroy but they would do things like, you hear, you would read, when you read these newspaper accounts of them, the women would carry the kegs of beer out to the street, right? And they would like smash them into the ground. But it was very visceral. Like they were going out and making this happen sometimes. And they would meet a lot of adversity. A lot of people would disagree with them. You know, even in the saloons, usually a saloon keeper had his family working with him. So usually there was a saloon keeper's wife who was largely, you know, running the business with him. And, you know, the saloon keeper's wife often, because the saloon keeper couldn't really attack these women, right? That would not be appropriate. But his wife could like get in their faces and like spit at them. And like, you know, people, you know, in different times, people like poured alcohol on them, you know, people spat at them, you know, people pushed, you know, women would get into like fights with them and like, you know, push them. So it got to be very, and they would also call the police, right? And say, well, this woman is, you know, not supposed to be on this property. And the police would come and arrest them in some places. And bring them to jail, and they would be singing hymns in the jail, you know, and they would refuse bail. You know, they did all this. These were very serious. You don't think about women in the 1870s, Christian, Midwestern, middle-aged women, you know, white women in the, you know, you don't think about them being as quite as sort of radical as they were, but they were 100% all about this. So I want to talk about five reasons why I think this became such an important movement, why five sort of principles that they use that I think were very powerful. And one of them was what I call be both local and boundless. That the Temperance Crusades were really, really interested in what was happening right where they were. Like every Temperance Crusade was profoundly local, right? You know, they're interested in the saloon on my corner, you know, in my town. So what it was a huge movement. It was national, right? They were communicating with each other, and we'll talk about that. But they were really interested in what's happening in my community. What about this lady that I know, you know, who doesn't have enough food because her husband is drinking it up, right? You know, what about this abused family, you know, around me, right? You know, what about this drunken young man who was so promising, but now, you know, we see him in the gutters, you know? And so they were very much interested in the profoundly local. And then at the same time, they were connected to each other and kind of talking to each other from community to community, but they never got abstract. They were never just like, we should close down all saloons. They're always like, we should close down this saloon, you know, right here. And that was part of their power. The second thing that I think is important about the temperance movement, or about the Crusades specifically, was that they had what I called framing that allowed breadth. So they were saying, okay, we should close down these saloons because drinking is bad and drinking causes all these problems. But from the very beginning, they were opening up the door to a broader body of problems. They were saying domestic violence is a problem. And I actually think, and we'll be talking about this a lot more, but I think this was the first anti-domestic violence movement, right? They're saying it's not okay. And they talked a lot, and they would bring out battered women who had actually joined. They'd say, you know, they would make it a point to say, well, they were kind of a respectable group, but they would bring out, you know, women who were maybe poor, who would come out and join them. And they would say, you get to take the first swing with a hatchet, right, at this barrel, because you have been battered, you know? So they framed their issue. We want to close down the saloons. It's a single issue, but they opened it up from the very beginning to have a lot of other possible, so women should have more power, right? They're kind of, you know, they're also saying like women should have more power. Women should have control over money. Women should be able to bring cases to the court, right? Which they couldn't do at this time. Only men could bring court cases. So if you wanted to sue your husband, or if you wanted to, you know, sue the saloon keeper for selling to your husband, you'd have to get a man to actually be the person who brought that case on your behalf, right? So they're actually, from the very beginning, they're actually opening up, even though they're doing something very specific, they're opening up the door to many different policy issues that it relates to. Okay. And there's a really great book recently. It was an anti-capitalist movement. You know, there's a really good book by a guy named Mark Schrod that was like, this was largely a movement about big saloon coming into our towns, right? And messing up our social structure. You know, so in a large way, it was connected to, you know, certain critiques of what, you know, predatory capitalism, right? And things like that. So it was a really broad framing from the very start. The next thing is, I'm going to say what I call touch the unclean thing. I use that framing because when people at that time, the temperance people had a phrase, don't touch the unclean thing, which was for men, the unclean thing is alcohol. They should never touch it, because if they took one drink, it could invade them, you know, and sort of take over their will, right? It was very dangerous to drink. So they would always say, touch not the unclean thing. But temperance women themselves, and I think this was actually really crucial, touched the unclean thing. Like, you know, I mentioned before, and I think I got some reaction kind of viscerally, that, like, you know, these women would go with their white dresses, their clean, you know, clothes, and they would kneel down on the floor of these saloons in the spit, right? Or whatever it was, you know, it was on those disgusting saloon floors. And also, like, just for them to go into, just walk through the door of a saloon, it's like, I think the best example would be, like, if you're like, I think crack is a problem. So we here at the church, like, are going to, like, walk into a crack house, right? And we're going to, like, sit down in the crack house. We're going to stay there until the problem is solved, right? That was, I think, more or less, like, what it felt like to these women. They were afraid to go in these places. They never would have gone to the only prostitutes, right, would go into saloons, right? Or really confused immigrant women, right? You know, he had to, like, but, you know, in generally, like, you know, only prostitutes would go into these saloons. But these women went in and they touched the unclean thing. But they did more than that. Like, they often, not often, but some of the leaders, you have a couple of moments, including Mother Stewart. Mother Stewart dresses up as here's where you get some of the racism. She dresses up as an Irish washerwoman. And she goes in to one of these saloons and gets them to illegally sell her, because it's Sunday and they're not supposed to be selling, gets her to illegally sell her whiskey. But in order to make it happen, she to make the lawsuit work, right? She drinks the whiskey, right? So these women actually believe that your first sip of alcohol makes you impure, right? And she goes right in there and she downs this, you know, dressed in this costume, she downs this whiskey and then she runs out, you know, and she now has the evidence to, like, get this guy arrested for, you know, whatever, for selling on Sunday. But they were willing to, like, really get in there. You know, they're willing to go to jail. My favorite example of this is actually from later, because I think it's a continuation, but Carrie Nation, you know, one of the most famous of these people who was later. Carrie Nation goes into a saloon once, and first she gets drunk. Carrie Nation drinks, she does an experiment. She's like, you know how bad alcohol is? Alcohol is so bad, this is what it does to me. And she drinks so much alcohol, she gets really drunk and she reels around so that, like, people can see, like, how devastating alcohol is. Again, just totally not appropriate, right? It would be, again, like, us not only going in to the crack house, but it would be like all of us saying, and we're going to use crack and we're going to show you what it does so that you will shut down. You know, maybe if you see all of us, you know, using crack and look what it does to us, this will, like, shock you into, you know, not doing this, right? Or not allowing alcohol. Okay, so they do all this, but Carrie Nation, she actually goes in, she drinks it, but she also, there's this moment when she hatchets a keg, and the beer goes spewing out of the keg. And it gets all over her. She says, I was completely saturated. So it's like these women are just like, they are not avoiding vice, but they're actually, in order to solve it, they're like diving into and saturating themselves with the vice that they're opposing. Yes. Yes, sure.
I thought it was so interesting that in a report, I was reading of the beverage industry from 2023, the greatest increase in beverages across the United States were in non-alcoholic beverages.
Yes.
I don't know if we can attribute it to this women's movement, but it's fascinating. And of course, they're drinks that are made to look like alcohol. So they're sold in the spirits and wine section as opposed to the fruit juice and so forth. But I thought that was really interesting. It's a lasting effect.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. And, I mean, I think with the non-alcoholic, we can talk about this, but I think it's because everybody drank a lot more starting with COVID. Our drinking rates increased very dramatically in the United States and elsewhere with COVID. And I think a lot of people had felt drinking problems that they're not happy with, right? And they're trying to, and this is like one of those tools that people are using. But yeah, no, that's a good point. The fourth point that I think that they were very good at was they said their idea was draw, not drive. And that was their phrase, draw, not drive. That instead of pushing people and like harassing people, that their goal was actually to bring people in, the saloon keepers. So ideally what they're trying to do is convince the saloon keepers, come to our side, and convince the drinkers, right? Come to our side, you know, draw, not drive. They actually never, the temperance movement was very positive about drinkers. Like they never were critical of, they didn't like the domestic violence, right? They didn't like the things that they were doing, right? But they never actually depersonalized, dehumanized, or lost sympathy with the drinkers. They always saw the drinkers as sympathetic people who should be helped, right? And they tended to see the saloon keepers as sympathetic people who should be helped. And their philosophy was draw, not drive, bring them in, right? Convince them to like join us, convince them to like be better. Never to, you know, stigmatize somebody, or, you know, they did sometimes try to get them arrested, right? You know, but that was the sort of philosophy of the movement, sort of draw, not drive, a sort of ethic of care. I have a quotation here from a crusader. She says, in Ohio, she says, "It is easy to conquer a man if you only know how. I wish you'd see me talking to some of these saloon men that I would never have spoken to before. I employ my sweetest accents. I exhaust all the argument I am possessed of. I look into their eyes and grow pathetic. I shed tears. I joke with them, but all in terrible earnest, and they surrender." Right. So it's very much like a using women's tactics, right, where that they are sort of to get power. And then the final thing, oh, and I'm going to say, I see a lot of the tactics they're using as similar to restorative justice, right? You know, they want to create a solution that's going to take all of the people, including the people who had caused the problem and the people who were harmed by the problem, together to like form a sort of solution. So I see it as a sort of, it's very similar to me to like current ideas about restorative justice approaches. Then finally, the tactic that they had was explode like a bomb, then grow like a tree. That is, when newspapers talked about the temperance crusades, they tended to talk about them in terms of explosion, a bomb. Like it was, nobody had ever seen anything like it. People didn't know what to do. It was crazy for them to see what was happening with these respectable women marching down the street and going into these saloons. It just was, it was incomprehensible, right? And it was a huge thing. It was so fast. It lasted from, you know, it just took off in January of 1874. It starts spreading. And then it's really everywhere until like the summer of 1874. And it's just so sudden and they don't know what to do with it. Women even kind of saw it as like their civil war. Like they had missed the Civil War, which had been less than a decade before, right? And that this is them. They often made that parallel. Like we're going out just as the men did to end slavery. Now we're going out, you know, to end the war on alcohol, or to end alcohol. But it was, they definitely called it a war. But then while they were doing this, they realized that the movement itself, if it was going to make any progress, was going to have to be long-term. So they did this very quick thing that they knew this wouldn't last forever, right? They did this 6-month thing and they're very intentional about it. But at the same time, they started building an organization and they started planning. So even as all this was happening, they're starting to lay the groundwork for a permanent organization, which would move much more slowly. And that's why I say explode like a bomb and grow like a tree. And the organization that they are, so all along in a whole bunch of they're writing letters to each other from place to place. People are traveling from place to place to talk about what their plans are. They're holding weekly meetings to say, how can we keep this going? How can we institutionalize this thing that we're experiencing? And they plan a meeting at Chautauqua in New York in August of 1874. So I want to go back now to Pittsburgh. So where is Francis Willard in 1874? Francis Willard, who's going to quickly become the guiding light of this movement, who's the one who's going to sort of take it over almost immediately and be at the head of it for almost his entire life, or most active life. Where she is Pittsburgh. So what she's doing at this time in 1874 is she is teaching at a place called the Pittsburgh Female College, which is later going to move, and it's going to become the Beaver College, which later they say, we can't do this. And they change their name again. It's now Acadiana College or something like that. But at this time, she is a young kind of lecturer, right, at a female college. And she becomes involved in these crusades. She goes out in Pittsburgh to the Pittsburgh Crusades, which I mentioned started at the Third Presbyterian Church, which at that time was at 6th and Cherry Alley. In Pittsburgh, the movement is like less successful, right? Because there's a lot of immigrants. The movement didn't do so well in cities. You know, they got arrested more. You know, they got arrested for obstructing sidewalks, you know, and stuff like that. And the saloons were less inclined to shut down. But they definitely went out every night in Pittsburgh, and they did these. And Frances Willard was among those who went out. And she says, her quote at this time, she says, all through the famous battle winter of home versus saloon, I read every word that I could get about the movement. Meanwhile, it occurred to me, strange to say for the first time, that I ought to work for the good cause just where I was, that everybody ought. Thus, I first received, quote, the arrest of thought, concerning which in 1,000 different towns I have since then tried to speak. And so she says, you must have this arrest of thought. You must have this sort of like moment of realization, what they later going to call the sort of like, you know, click moment. And I believe that in the simple change from passive to aggressive, from her passive acceptance of social problems to sort of her aggressive decision to address social problems, lies the only force that can free this land from the drink habit and the liquor traffic. So she's mobilized then by this, this crusade. She goes out and participates in it. And then she is one of the leaders. When they get to, they first have this meeting in Chautauqua in August, and they have a second bigger meeting in Cleveland in November of 1874, from November 18th through 20th, and they form a new society, which does immediately become the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Frances Willard says, its object was to preserve the fruits. Are we looking at Frances here? Let's look at Frances now while we're, here we go. And that's her. I tried to get one that was about her age at the time. That's a relatively younger Frances Willard. She says, its object was to preserve the fruits of crusade victory. Indeed, it may be justly called the sober second thought, making a joke, right, of that unparalleled uprising. Women from 18 states were gathered. Something divine was in the air, a breath of the new dispensation. Introductions were at a discount. We shook hands all round, and we have been comrades ever since. And they are going to begin, and I'll talk in the next three lectures, the amazing things that they do, because they change a lot in American political life and American cultural life. And it all begins with this very explosive, very surprising movement. So, okay. I think I will stop there and ask for questions if people have questions. Yes, John.
If you were doing, as you do, research on all this, where would you go in Pittsburgh to get access to documents, books? Would Carnegie Library or some other place be a...
I would love, and I've had a student actually, I was looking for this because it's, I have it somewhere. She did a map of the crusades in Pittsburgh. So somewhere I have a map, which I can't find. It was a master's student, just killing me. The only sources I've been able to find so far, because I haven't done a full, I've done a little bit of research on the Crusades, but, and I do plan my next, my book after policing is going to be on Francis Willard. So I'm planning to go back to it. It's also relevant to my policing book, right? But the only sources I can find other than her own, you know, she has a great biography called Glimpses of 50 Years, a great autobiography. She talks about it just a tiny bit, but the only thing that I can really find is newspapers, but there are a lot of newspapers. So like basically there were so many newspapers in Pittsburgh at the time. There were like, I don't know, 15, you know, newspapers in Pittsburgh in different languages, stuff like that. So there's a lot that we haven't tapped into, but especially if anybody's an ancestry.com person and like, you know, all into that, get that newspapers.com thing that I was trying to pitch. It's great. And you can totally find dozens at least of articles about the Crusades in Pittsburgh. So for instance, there was a day in Pittsburgh where all of the, it was in March of 1873 or 1874, where like all of the ministers, not all of them, I'm sure, but many ministers preached sermons about in support of the Crusade, including the Southside Presbyterian Church was one of the ones that was quoted at length. I don't know what that is now. They then like kind of reprinted the text of those sermons, you know, in one of the newspapers. But if you go through those papers from 1874, they covered, like, if you picked up a newspaper in 1874, between like February and June of, 1874, you would find it would take over, like often be most of the front page. It would say, well, how's the crusade doing in Cleveland? Well, what's going on with the crusade? Crusade's going to start in New York City. Will it work? No. Right. But it's like, you know, it was all over the place. So the newspapers are by far the best source for these. I haven't found like a memoir of like somebody who was involved other than just a very short memory, you know, mentioned by Francis Willard. So it's possible things are how we have found. I'd love to see arrest records, but there's also, they didn't do a very good job keeping the arrest records, but there were definitely a lot of them were arrested in Pittsburgh. So, yeah.
Did it effectively close down if a town, this movement, would all the saloons close, or is this the early, sort of the launching of speakeasies? Did they gather elsewhere to drink? I'm surprised the guys give up their beer.
Well, so here's where we have sourcing problems. I also agree with you, but probably everybody didn't stop drinking. You know, in these towns, sometimes they would declare complete victory. They would list all the saloons, they'd say, and it wasn't just saloons. They would also be shutting down groceries, or at least having them stop their sale of alcohol, and pharmacies, right? You know, which were largely selling alcohol. They would claim that they had total victory. Now, does that mean you can't, you know, get on your horse and go to the next town? Like, you know, so I don't think, you know, and also all the places that closed, drinking rates don't decrease after this, right? So it is a short victory, right? And there all these places will come back or be replaced by something else, you know. So it is, it, in itself, it doesn't like change. The only thing the Crusade does is it teaches women to be activists, right? And particularly conservative, Christian, Midwestern, middle-aged women. It teaches them to be activists, which they had never done before, right? Teaches them to run meetings. You know, it teaches them to date their correspondents, you know, things like just skills of just activism. And to speak in public, which is something that still a lot of women were not comfortable doing. you know, but also it forms networks, right? So that's the work of this. But the most important thing it does is it launches the WCTU, which will keep working at this for decades. Yeah.
Do you trust the internet? Let's say if you go on Google, would Google provide you with accurate information on historical things, or would it tailor the answer to what they know about you and your whatever that's called? You know, they have.
Yeah. Well, so I'm listening. That's a question I know a lot about because I teach, and my students often write about, you know, want to do papers about the Temperance Movement, and I have gotten some really funny stuff. You know, like for instance, there was a group of men who were making fun of the Temperance Movement. And so they dressed up as women and they held up, there were probably like college students, right? And they held up a sign that said, "Lips that touch wine will never touch mine." And they're like wearing bonnets and everything like that. And, you know, it was really actually pretty funny, right? You know, but they were like doing this, like, you know, so they cross-dressed, right? And they, as, and they put up this "lips that touch wine." Well, I had a student use that as like, you know, the Temperance Movement, like that was their image of the Temperance Movement. She didn't understand that this was a mocking image. You know, she had no idea what it was. She just like picked it out right from the, you know, didn't understand that this was not the Temperance Movement. But what I do, there's some sites that are very good. I go for .edu sites, right? Usually. So .edu or .gov sites. There's a lot of really good collections of temperance stuff on the internet. In fact, you can find almost anything you need on the internet, but you just have to be careful that you know who's creating it and why. But there certainly are a lot of fake information out there about that. Now, and also like, yeah, the algorithms are going to take you to this place or that place. Yeah, that's true. Yes.
Pittsburgh History Landmarks Foundation or whatever that did a very good presentation of the temperance movement in Pittsburgh a number of years ago. It was one of those programs that they had that lasted several weeks. So I don't remember who it was.
Yeah,
did it, but it was really well done. I mean, they spent a lot of money to make it very accessible to the public.
Oh, I should go track that down. That's awesome. And the Heinz History Center had a big event on like the Prohibition. Yeah, which was late. It didn't have that much for the earlier, but it was really good on the Prohibition. But it had stuff for it. Did have some stuff for the. I actually spoke as part of that. I did like a little talk in the middle of that, but. Yeah, no, that was a really awesome, that was a very impressive display. You were going to say something. You had a question.
I need help with history here, but I'm just wondering how much this is sort of lays the groundwork for modern day protests, modern day civil disobedience. I mean, there they were smashing stuff and In that case, though, I don't think their intent, or maybe it was, to be put in jail, and then they could. That gives them a platform too. Anyway, I was just wondering how much of this is a foundation for modern day protest movements.
That's a really good question. Now, so like the big movement that had been before it, right? That it's kind of had to be thinking of, like, if you're sitting there in 1873 and you're like, how can I do a social movement? You're almost certainly thinking about the abolition movement, right? You know, which is still pretty recent, and was very, you know, so they're gonna borrow some tactics from the abolition movement, but I'll tell you what, a lot of what they're doing is brand new, you know.
That's what it sounds like to me. So. Uh-huh.
I think so. I think it's, and that's, I like how you framed that actually. I'm trying to think now of like, did the abolition movement, to what extent did it do? Like, it wasn't, I mean, there were abolitionist marches, right? But the abolitionists tended to have fairs instead of marches. Like, I feel like taking over public spaces you know, which is like the women were like, you know, going out and they were marching to the saloons, you know, and they were like being very parading. There were abolitionist parades, but that wasn't really big for it wasn't really big for the abolitionist movement. And like, sort of like, you know, did anybody go undercover as an enslaved person, you know, or something like that, which might be like the equivalent to this, you know, kind of going into, you know, touch the unclean thing. I mean, I don't really think that they did, you know, they did like abolitionists did make it a point to often be physically proximate to Black people, right? Which was something which was kind of not, you know, seen as sort of like not done, but like there were like Abby Kelly, for instance, who was an abolitionist. She allowed herself to be escorted somewhere by Frederick Douglass. You know, he was touching her, you know, and that was very not cool, you know, to a lot of people. So they did some of that kind of like, and then the abolitionists also, did they try not to hate the slaveholders? You know, sometimes they, you know, they, you know, the Quakers, for instance, you know, who were so important in the abolitionists, that would have been a Quaker idea, right? To kind of draw on that, you know. So I think it's definitely influenced by abolitionism, but I think in a lot of ways it's really new. Yeah.
I also want to make a plug for women's activities in church that helped them organize. And it was something that I think maybe a little bit later, like Frances Willard, she really was able to tie into the women in churches and their movements and their, their mission, missionary work.
That's what she did. Yeah, no, that's exactly what she did. What it was, I mean, the Women's Christian Temperance Union succeeded because it was organizing through existing networks of church women. And I should have said that more clearly even, because that's a really important point, but that's exactly what it did. It organized through the churches. Yeah. I mean, I think networks, we've come to appreciate networks a lot more recently. A lot of historians now are focusing on network building. But especially to the extent that we like take the approach of network building, that's exactly what happened. We were able to exploit Christian networks, which is also what the abolitionists had done, right? The abolitionists, you know, were largely exploiting, you know, church networks. But yeah, no, totally. I agree.
I'm curious. Alcohol is clearly not a healthful, substance to consume. Even in what we might consider moderate amounts. And so today there's still a lot of ferment about how much drinking is healthy. We just finished Dry January. Guidelines have been proposed and opposed by the alcohol industry to advise people that one drink a day is about the most you can do if you're female, two maybe for a male, one or two for a male. All that aside, looking back to this context, I'm wondering if my impression that temperance is a uniquely American phenomenon, the temperance movement, why it didn't take hold in other cultures such as in England, where the pubs are deeply entrenched in the culture of the community and not seen as an evil institution so much like the saloons, or maybe I'm wrong. I'm just curious about
that. It actually did. Yeah, it did. And that, there was like a big temperance movement in England, particularly in England, there was a sort of massive temperance movement. But there was, and in fact, Frances Willard will end her days in England, living with a lady, Henry Somerset, who was a temperance person there. But so in England, it's really, really big. In Russia, it's crazy, right? Like actually in Russia, because the Imperial Russian government was actually dependent upon taxes on alcohol, they actually sent in troops to brutally repress and beat temperance people, right? There was actually huge temperance movements that were brutally repressed by the Russian government because they needed the income, you know, from the vodka. And it was like, but, and also like, you know, certainly in Scandinavia, where they had huge problems, you know, with drinking, a huge, also huge temperance movements. So this is very much, and in fact, the WCTU is going to become the WWCTU. It's going to grow into the World's Women's Christian Temperance Union. They're going to go, we'll talk about this, but they go everywhere. They go to India, they go to Africa, you know, they certainly go to all the European nations and don't go there, but that those nations join them, you know, in this, there's a great book that I'm going to recommend by a friend of mine named Mark Schrod. It's a massive doorstopper of a book, but it's called Smashing the Liquor Machine. And, it's a history of global temperance that focuses on it as an anti-capitalist movement. So, you know, which you think it's so fascinating because you think of it as conservative, right? A conservative movement, but, you know, it also has this, you know, other element to it. Yeah.
Did they get traction?
They didn't succeed in closing down the pubs. No. And, you know, again, for the same reason, you know, that, or, you know, for whatever reason, but, you know, they got a lot of resistance from the state. Yeah. So, but yeah, no, there's a lot written about the British temperance movement. It was very serious. Yeah. So.
I have an observation. In my law practice, I've represented women in the sex industry, you know, as a defense lawyer. And I found it very curious that men didn't rise up against the sex industry is harmful. Some seem to support it. That's a curious fact, I think.
Yeah. Well, the WCTU, and we'll get to this also, is that the WCTU also was very invested in ending the sex industry. It actually was, that was one of its, it stormed right in there, just like it stormed into the saloons. It's going to storm into the opium dens. It's going to storm into, you know, the prostitution court or the red district, red light districts and stuff like that. So that's actually, there is a huge anti-prostitution movement, though you are correct that really what's happening with prostitution right now in like the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s is sort of the creation of these red light districts where prostitution is tolerated, which of course also is always going to involve where alcohol is tolerated. So part of what's happening, well, there's so much to talk about, but it's a creation of segregation. Like the first use of segregation is for disease segregation and vice segregation before it becomes associated with racial segregation. And that's what's happening right at this time is like this kind of idea, well, what if we segregate the different functions of the city, right? And put all the vice in like one area, and that will definitely be prostitution. It'll be alcohol. So it's all connected. And the WCT will get there eventually. Yeah. Okay. I guess that's probably it then. I even hear the bell. So
thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.